I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Posh Nosh Gal, and I have the amazing Paul Ainsworth with me today. Hailing originally from Southampton, Paul is recognised as the king of gastronomy in the southwest of England and a regular on our TV screens. From his home in Padstow in Cornwall, he and his wife Emma have transformed that quaint seaside town into the best culinary venue in the region. Starting with the Michelin-starred Paul restaurant at number six, Paul Ainsworth, sorry, at number six, they also now run Cafe Rojano near the port, a pub, a small luxury hotel, a cookery school, and a chef's table. Hi, Paul, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Shalina, that's like the best introduction ever. throughout this whole thing, doing various interviews and Zooms, there's been some good introductions, but you have just nailed it. Thank you.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
I'll take that.
Well, happy birthday for yesterday. It was your birthday.
Thank you very much. Do you know what? I had the best day ever. All things considered, last year was my 40th, and you probably think my 40th would have been like one of the birthdays to remember. But we opened the Mariners on May the 16th, and my birthday was on May the 21st, and I just wasn't there. I just wanted to be at the Mariners, and it was a brand new business. We'd invested so much into it in terms of money, time, everything. I just couldn't switch off. I couldn't relax. And my wife was like, look, you're only going to be 40 once. You've got to switch off. And I just couldn't, that's just me. So yesterday, considering you think, well, we're in lockdown. The world's in a very, very, difficult place at the minute. But I actually had the best birthday ever. I took my little girl fishing for the first time. Just the three of us went. We took a picnic. The sun was shining, it's a beautiful fishery in Tavistock, and I just literally had the best day with my girls. It was amazing.
Oh, lovely. So, Paul, you were born into the hospitality trade, and your parents ran a guest house. At what point did you ever think that you'd want to do something else?
It's a good question. I didn't think I was going to go into catering and hospitality from a young age. I didn't have any of those romantic stories, like you hear, amazing stories like Raymond Blanc, telling you about, Mama Blanc, with the vegetables and the tomato juice and running home from school. I had none of that. What I did have was a mum and dad that had a business that basically me and my sister were involved in, because the business was our home and it was a 10 bedroom bed and breakfast. So I was born into hospitality. So when the phone rang and you were hoping it was your mates, I had to start off the phone call by good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever. Welcome to Biddon Park Guest House. My name is Paul. How can I help you?
Yeah.
And kind of that was just didn't know any different. That's what we grew up with. So when I got to the age of school, so what was that? That would have been 13, 14, where you choose work experience. I chose four really random places. One of them was a hotel. And I said to my dad, I'm really, really going to try and get a job here. Because previous to that, I didn't have the romantic gastronomic stories, but what I did have was a mum and dad, and certainly my dad, that had instilled a work ethic into me that was just, it was amazing. But I didn't realise how amazing that was until I was much older in life. So by the time I was 12 years old, I had four paper rounds. I used to put the inserts into the tabloids at the weekend, like the Times, the Telegraph and all the Guardian, all the inserts, Saturday and Sunday. I worked at a fruit and veg merchant's five nights a week. And then I also saw an ad in the paper for Betterware. Now, I don't know if you remember Betterware, but Betterware was this kind of, I would deliver a catalogue to you, to my catchment area. You would then look through this catalogue and look at basically stuff that might be a way of housing your shower gels in the shower and that. So you'd order it. I would come back, collect the catalogue, deliver it back to you, your shower gel holder, and I would take a commission on it. So I was I was extremely hardworking. I was always, you know, looking at how I could earn money. And I knew that if I earned money, I could buy myself those Nike Air Max trainers. And that was literally what it was. So once I decided I wanted to be a chef, this work ethic actually then played, you know, really paid dividend, because the type of kitchens I went on to work in, you had to have a work ethic. I mean, when you're working in, you know, kitchens such as Royal Hospital Road for Gordon Ramsay, for Trusenat, you know, these are long, long days. Oh, they were back then.
Yeah.
Still are now, but you know, you've got to have a work ethic. So the cooking side of thing, that did come naturally, and I loved it, and I was very lucky. My mum's from the Seychelles, and my mum was a brilliant cook, but what is interesting, so was my dad. Right. But when you would go around friends' houses at 10 years old, mums did all the cooking. Dads were useless. They didn't do any cooking. But my dad did. So my dad cooked Monday to Thursday for all the guests. And then my mum took over Friday to Sunday, and she did like Seychellois style cooking. Whereas my dad would be, you know, real good British kind of, you know, meat and potato pies, roast dinners, shepherd's pies, stuff like that. So yeah, that was kind of, you know, a bit of a brief kind of, you know, overview of my journey into cooking.
And would you say that your work ethic, did it come naturally to you, or was it instilled more by your parents?
Both. Definitely instilled by my parents. And if they hadn't have instilled it, I would have then just been a product of, you know, of whatever. But you know, I had a very, very strict upbringing. My mum comes from the Seychelles. So she had seven sisters, one brother, and Mamé, which is obviously my grandmother, and Tata, my grandfather, they were strict. Really, really strict family. And my dad also came from a very, very strict family. And I think that work ethic, you know, my gran and granddad in the UK were extremely hardworking. So were Mamé and Tata. They were, you know, my gran and granddad in the UK were just hardworking folk, you know, two up, two down. Whereas my grandparents in the Seychelles were very entrepreneurial. They were, you know, they had their own business. So kind of I was just born into this kind of work ethic. And, you know, going into the industry I chose, you've got to have a work ethic, because quite honestly, there's easier jobs to do. Yeah. And when you're cooking at the level, you know, that I've cooked at when I was working for people, and the level that I want my businesses to be in Padstow, it involves a lot of hours. It involves a lot of hard work. And in order to sort of cook and give your guests this incredible experience in hospitality, you can't just do that 9 to 5. Yeah. You can't do that easily. And that was something, you know, when I started working for Gordon that I really realized. And I'll tell you a great story which just sums it up. I've been working for Gordon for about a month, and he had been asked to do the food at Ascot. So we finished like a grueling week, Monday to Friday, and restaurant Gordon Ramsay was shut Saturday, Sunday. So Sunday we're driving down to Ascot, and you know, we're in Gordon's car, and you know, Gordon wasn't as famous as what he is now. And we stopped over, and we had a full English breakfast at a Little Chef. And we went in there, and there was this woman, and she was cooking the breakfast. She had this hat on. The hat was literally covering her eyes. She had a name on her hat. She was kind of griddling eggs and doing what she was doing. And I always remember Gordon saying to me, he was like, listen, there's many avenues in the catering and hospitality industry. You know, if you want to kind of, you know, do an 8-hour day, he said, like, come and work here and do what that, you know, do what that lady's doing. But if you want to work at the highest level, you've got to understand, and you've got to make your bed and lie in it. You've got to put the hard yards in. You've got to put the hours in. And that's always stuck with me. And there has been times, certainly when I got to restaurant Gordon Ramsay, where I was like, is this what I want to do? Is this? But I didn't know anything else, and I don't think I wanted to try and learn anything else. So I just thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I've got to accept it, do it, and make the best out of it. And if you do work hard in this, and if you do work hard at this industry, for me, it's one of the most incredible, brilliant, beautiful industries in the world, because it's an industry based on people, and I love people, and I built my businesses on being about the people and the quality of the people that's in them.
Yeah. Well, taking you back, I mean, your daughter is actually very, very young. Would you encourage the same attitude or work ethic in her as well?
Definitely. You know, I would, you know, there's certain things you change, isn't there? You think that, like, well, I'm my own personnel. You know, my dad used to say the same thing to me. He'd be like, you know, there's things that your gran and granddad brought me up with that we haven't done with you and Michelle. Michelle's my sister. Mm-hmm. I think one thing I'm learning more than anything, but the world that I grew up in is a very different world now to the world that Cece's going to grow up in. And we all know that social media and the internet and all of that, it really has changed the world. And I think ultimately I just want Reese to be happy. And, you know, no one sort of ever said that to me. I'm glad, you know, I was very ambitious, very driven, still am. But ultimately, you know, life, you know, I lost my dad 4 years ago. And, you know, Shalina, I'd moved out by the time I was 15 years old. And because I just thought that that's what you needed to do. Go, 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 go. And, you know, and you know, I missed out on a lot of, like, family time at home and spending that quality time with my family and stuff, because it was just work, work, work. Yeah. And, you know, it's good. And like you say, it's got me to this position. But, you know, there's been a lot of sacrifice with that. And ultimately, I just want Reese to be happy, and I'm not going to put that pressure on her. I'm not saying my mum and dad put pressure on me, but there was pressure, because that's what they knew. And I'm just going to, as long as she's happy and as long as she kind of believes in herself and she doesn't get dragged into, you know, we are in a generation of comparing ourselves, aren't we? And looking at everybody's Instagram and, like, thinking that everybody's life is just perfect and that, when it's not. No one's life is, whether you're David Beckham or whether you're, you know, like, you know, unknown, no one's life is perfect. And my main goal for Arisi is just to work hard, have a great work ethic, understand the value for money, but ultimately be happy. Because I think if you're happy, you're a millionaire.
Amazing. Well, you mentioned earlier on you had lots of jobs going on while you were at school. You also worked your way through catering college as well. What was it that benefited you the most? Was it the theory or the practical experience?
Practical. Absolutely. That's a good question. So anyone that was back with me in those days knows that Paul Ainsworth was theory. When it comes to the end of washing up at the end, because at college you've got to do all your own washing up, I was nowhere to be seen. And the theory is a good one, right? So I was working full time in the industry. No one knew this. None of my college lecturers knew this, bar one. And he was a guy called Freddie, right? And the reason he knew, because he would moonlight at the same hotel I was working at full time.
Oh, wow.
But then it turns out that when I joined college, he was a college lecturer. He was my college tutor. So when I wasn't there, he would mark me in, right?
Oh, brilliant.
And I'm not condoning this, but the reason he did was because he knew I wasn't at home, led in bed or sat on my ass playing video games or something like that. He knew that I was getting a brilliant education working in the industry. Yeah. So the best bit about this story is there was a few kind of the theory lecturers, like the French teacher and all that, they did have it in for me. They thought that I was just not applying myself and all of this. Because if I was late, Shalina, it was because I was doing breakfast and I had to get the buffet set up before I left. So I would get to college about 10 past nine, quarter past nine regularly. And they just thought that I was, like, taking the mick. Yeah. So anyway, at the end of the year, if you had above 80% attendance, you were allowed to go on the trip to Euro Disney. Anyway, I rock up on the coach with my rucksack to go to Euro Disney, and I always remember this lecturer called Steve Batten saying, "How on earth are you on this trip?" And I was like, "Because I've got above 80% attendance, Mr. Batten." Again, don't mistake, it wasn't because I was riding, it wasn't because I had a little loophole in the system, it was because I had a lecturer that knew I was working harder than any, you know, while all the other students were doing stuff that students do, chilling out on the green, going to the pub, I was doing breakfast at the Star Hotel. I'd go to college. As soon as college would finish, I'd run back over to the Star Hotel and do evening service.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, this is what led you to working with Gary Rose, because one of your tutors recommended you. So that must be an amazing way to start your career.
The best. I was just coming to the end of college. Martin Nash, who was an amazing lecturer, absolutely amazing. He was godfather to Gary Rhodes' children. Gary rang the college, said, we're just opening up a brand new restaurant in Pimlico called Rhodes in the Square. Would you like, have you got any students? And I just literally won Student Chef Year. It was like an in-house competition. So Martin said to me, look, do you want to move to London? I was like, absolutely, this is the break. Problem was London rent. So Gary put me up in London, three of us up in London, rent free above the restaurant, because the restaurant was within a hotel, for 3 months. I had enough money to save up for a deposit, and because you know what London's like, deposit 6 months up, 6 weeks up front.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was my kind of foot in the door to London, and working for Gary Rhodes was, you know, it was an incredible experience, like absolutely incredible. And I was there when, you know, when it won a Michelin star. I learned so much there. And then from Gary Rhodes was when I went to Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, so you worked with some of the best chefs in the industry. So Gordon Ramsay, Martin Waring after that. You've already told us a story about Gordon Ramsay. Tell us one about Marcus Waring.
Oh, Marcus Waring, lots. The move from restaurant Gordon Ramsay to Petrus was one that I didn't plan. After restaurant Gordon Ramsay, I wanted to go abroad, but I wanted to go abroad perhaps for the wrong reasons. And Gordon talked me out of it. And, you know, some will say for his own, you know, for his own gain, but it was kind of true. I wanted to go to Australia, but I was looking at Australia not from a culinary perspective. I was looking at it as, the good life. And like quite rightly, Gordon was like, if you want to carry on in and work at the highest level, I don't believe going to Australia, certainly back then, so this was 2003, is the right move for you. He was like, you need to keep on working hard and working in the best kitchens. So they promoted me from chef de partie at Royal Osborne Road to sous chef at Petrus. And actually, it was the best decision I could have ever made, because Gordon and Marcus were obviously very, very tight, but actually their cooking styles were very different. Marcus was almost on the attack. You know, there was more things on the plate. There was a lot more kind of going on with his cuisine, whereas Gordon's was, you know, Gordon and, you know, again, being part of Royal Hospital Road, I had been there from 2 stars to 3 stars. Mm-hmm. Something that actually now I look back, how many chefs have worked in a restaurant where it's gone from 2 stars to 3 stars, you know, it's because it's a really rare thing. You know, you've got to look back at the Michelin guide over the last, 10, 15 years. And I don't think we had a 3 star for about 10 years. So it was a magical thing to be a part of. So working for Marcus was really, you know, something quite different. Stories. I don't know if there's any I can really tell on here. Marcus. You know, Marcus was. You know, he was a real stickler for discipline. He was a brilliant. You know, he was a brilliant technician. He really was. And working at Petrus, you know, it was a real huge part of my career, and I loved it. And as I'm talking to you, I'm trying to rack my brains of a story. I might come back to one. I might come back to one.
So after 8 years in London, you moved to Padstow in Cornwall. So what was it about the place that you loved so much?
Look, Cornwall's beautiful, but like a lot of people, I'd only come down here on holiday as a kid. That was it. I had never had any aspirations or anything to move to Cornwall. What brought me to Cornwall was actually a move from London to set up a little restaurant for a family in Chislehurst in Kent. And I had a couple of lads that came with me, and one of those lads, knew Cornwall quite well. The move to Chislehurst was a short one. It wasn't quite what I wanted. I didn't then know what I was going to do. I didn't know whether to go back working for Gordon. I didn't know whether to go abroad. I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I, long story short, I took the small team that I had with me in, you know, outside the restaurant. We went down in it all at like Cutway, and I said, listen, guys, thank you so much for supporting me. I think we all know that this isn't, you know, what we want, and it, you know, we're not going anywhere with this. So from that, one of the guys turned around and said, listen, I'd love, my dad was looking at, you know, buying a restaurant for me in Cornwall. I'd love to kind of work with you guys. So, so basically, one of the lads, his name is Chris, said, look, before we all part company, it'd be just great if you met my dad. So we met with Chris's dad, a guy called Derek, and he said, look, there's a place called Padstow. Now, this is, you know, life, isn't it? This is quite mad. I had actually gone to Padstow for the first time ever, pretty much a year to having this conversation previous.
Right.
And like everybody else, I'd come down here because I wanted to eat at Rick Stein's, and I booked a table. Anyway, I'd actually even peered into number 6. It was all shut up and had a big for sale sign in the window. So I said, okay, let's. So we met with his dad, and he said, right, go down to Padstow. So I went down here, and again, I didn't move here because it was beautiful and it was lovely. All I wanted was an opportunity, a break. Somewhere to kind of show what I could do properly, you know. And back then it was all about the cooking, yeah. You know, it was just somewhere that it wasn't about anything else, and I didn't understand anything else. I just needed a platform, a kitchen and a dining room to try and show, you know, the world like what I could do. That was it. And from that, everything else then started to happen, and I quickly realized that actually it's not just about the cooking. I need to understand that if I'm going to put a dish on the menu, I need to understand that there's consequences to that dish, VAT, margin, like the profitability from that dish, everything in knowing how to run a restaurant. And I didn't know any of those things, and those things were taught to me by Derek, you know, Chris's father. So really fast forwarded in three years later, four of us moved down here. One of them was my girlfriend at the time. Me and her split up. She moved back to Denmark. Dave found Padstow a bit claustrophobic. He was a proper London boy. Chris, Derek's son, he moved on. So then it was just me left. So Derek offered me the lease and said, look, if you want to take the lease on, I'll support you. I'll continue to give you the knowledge and the support of running a business, but it's you now, it's you on your own. Now, by now, me and Emma are together. So me and Emma are like, right, we want to do this. My dad was right behind it. My mum was very nervous because it was right on the cusp of that kind of Labour period, and then the Tories coming in after Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And there was a bit of a recession. And that was the making of number 6. Because up until that point, I didn't have any of my own style. I didn't have any of my own, like my own personality. All I was doing was running number 6 with a group of guys, and we were cooking food that we had cooked in London with Gordon and Marcus. We were serving how we were serving in London. And it was only until it became me on my own and I had to take the responsibility and the name, the bills had my name on, that then it became real. It became proper real. And that was the making of number 6. And me and Emma went for a meal at Arbutus by Anthony Dimitri. Those kind of restaurants were few and far between. But what Anthony was doing, he was doing a style of food, and it was all stripped back and no tablecloths and any of that. Now that's quite normal now, but back then it wasn't. And I just said to Emma, this is what we need to do in number 6. So we called it Paul Ainsworth at number 6. We took the lease on. I did a lunch menu for £5 a course, £13.50 for 3 courses. I didn't make any money, but I washed my face and I promoted number 6. It got people in number 6. And then we got rid of the tasting menus, canapés, amuse-bouches, pre-desserts, all of that. Just did an a la carte menu. And it's kind of still what number 6 stands for now. I can't do the £5 a course, £13.50 for 3 courses anymore. Yeah. But that same ethos, that same values that we had then is exactly where we are now. We're number 6. And here we are. here we are 13 years on. I've been in PADSO for a total of 15 years, but 16 years, but 13 years as Paul Ainsworth at number six and yeah. everything else.
So we'll talk about everything else a little bit later. But I mean, you've never looked back, I guess. You know, haven't looked back ever since. But don't you miss London?
No, it's the honest answer. I love going up to London and I love London. But in the last, I would probably say 2 years, I've really like understood and appreciated where it is I live. And that's a lot of that is to do with a Reese of having a little girl.
Yeah.
But now when I look and you know, like some days a day I try to consistently take off and I go for we wake up, we have breakfast, you know, we live in the countryside, and then we get the dogs into the car and we all go down to the beach and we might go to Watergate Bay, we might go to Damer Bay, Rock Beach, Padstow Beach. And I honestly pinch myself. I can't believe that I live here and I've managed to make a living here. And I don't miss London. I don't miss London one bit. London was, I could have never have got to where I've got to without London. Because when I wanted to be a chef, London was where it's at. The only two places I knew of outside London were Gidley Park and Le Manoir Cat Saison. That was it. Whereas now, outside of London, there's so many incredible, amazing restaurants. But back then, there wasn't like, you know, there wasn't that amount of restaurants, and London was where it's at. And don't get me wrong, going up to London, going and seeing a show, going and eating out in a, you know, in a great restaurant, shopping, all of that, I love it. But you know what? I equally love driving home or getting on that train or flying into Newquay Airport and coming back to Cornwall. Cornwall is home and I adore it here.
Yeah, well, I've actually never been to Padstow, but I hear it's quicker by train to Paris than it is to Padstow.
Probably, but I tell you what, it's better when you get to Padstow than it is Paris.
Well, it's clearly a beautiful location. What have you been doing to keep yourself busy during lockdown?
So during lockdown, obviously I've been very busy because it's been about managing cash flows and making sure that our business survives. Because as you can imagine, we've lost all income like everybody else. But just because you lose all income doesn't mean you lose all your outgoings. Far from it. So it's been about managing the outgoings and making sure that we are in a position to reopen. In a position to not make any redundancies and look after our team. So that has kept me very, very busy. Mm-hmm. Then we've been cooking for the community every Friday. So Padstow, Rock, Pulse F, Weybridge, we've been looking after like the care workers and some NHS staff. And, you know, we've been doing as much as we can for the community. Because like I say, Cornwall and the community I'm in, Padstow, Rock, Weybridge, has been incredible for me, to me. So I've been doing my best to look after them, and my team have been helping me do that, and they have been phenomenal. So yeah, they're the main things that I've been doing through lockdown. As I speak to you now, the reason that you can probably hear that background noise is tonight is our first night of doing takeaway. So we're going to be doing takeaway tonight from Padstow, and then tomorrow night from Rock. And again, the support from the community is phenomenal. It's been absolutely phenomenal. We've done pre-order, so obviously make it safe for when people come and collect their food, and also prepayment. And it's been brilliant. And yeah, do you know what? You know, we've had to really think about the whole takeaway thing, because I can't make that mistake of thinking, oh yeah, we'll do takeaway. Because if it costs me money, or we break even, we can't do it. There's no point to do it.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be unfurloughing our team and then they're losing out because it's not a success. So it's really had to have a lot of thought process to make it viable. So yeah, and it can only be viable by, you know, the people using it, and everybody is, you know, using it. So yeah, we're incredibly grateful to the support from that. So yeah, I've been really busy, and I've also made myself totally busy with my wife Emma and my little daughter Cece and our dogs Flossie and Freddie. And the family time has been the silver lining for me for this is, you know, my daughter was due to start school in September, and I always wanted this year to try and dedicate as much time as I could to my family. And this has given me an opportunity to just have so much time with them. And I've loved it. I've absolutely loved it.
So just going a little bit back to the support, you mentioned support in your community. You obviously receive what you give back. So in 2011, you actually appeared on the BBC's Great British Menu, where your dessert was chosen to represent the Southwest, and you invited two local charities to join the feast in London. Which other charities are you passionate about?
Cornwall Air Ambulance. So most recently, we were asked to be ambassadors for Cornwall Air Ambulance, me and Emma. Yeah. And the mission was called the Heli Appeal. And it literally was a mission to raise £2.5 million to buy a new helicopter. So the current helicopter was coming up for 20 years old. Obviously, technology's moved on. But the main problem was the fuselage was... So if you were a patient in the fuselage of the helicopter, the medics could only work one side. But if your damage was, say, down this side, they had to reach over you, and it's very awkward. So the new helicopter meant that the medics could work on you from a 360-degree, basically, circle. Mm-hmm. So that was some task. And me and Emma did not raise the whole £2.5 million, you know, by ourselves. But we contributed, I would say, about £200,000, which, as you know, is, you know, it's a lot of fundraising. So we did fundraising events in London, in Padstow, and we put cards on the table for people to donate in. So that was how we raised all the money that we did. I ran the London Marathon for pancreatic cancer. So pancreatic cancer was what my dad died from. And I raised £46,000 for them. And that was just purely through my social media accounts, my Instagram and my Twitter. And we've donated money and helped raise money for Padstow RNLI, because my granddad was part of the RNLI in Blackpool. So yeah, they're kind of some of the charities that I've really kind of associated myself with. We get charity requests every single day. I can't afford to donate to them every day, but I listen to every single one. So Carol, she's my PA, she'll then go through all of the charity requests with me. And some days it's just physically like, yeah, do you know what? It pulls on your heartstrings and it's a nice story, but you just can't physically afford to keep giving. Yeah. But then there'll be ones that come in and you've just got an association with them. You just kind of, they just hit you right there, and you just kind of like, right, yeah, we'll donate dinner for two, a night at the townhouse, a champagne lunch at the Mariners and stuff. So yeah, you know, charity is hugely important to me, because I'm a big believer in life. You know, you can't just take, you've got to give back. And that's what I'm doing right now. You know, Padstow and Rock have been phenomenal to me. You know, they've been absolutely amazing. And right now there's a lot of people self-isolating. There's a lot of elderly people that can't get out, and they look forward to that meal that we cook for them every Friday.
Yeah, well, that's really wonderful. I mean, this community spirit that I think is shown in the last few weeks has just been, it's been phenomenal. So restaurants are, restaurants are one of the businesses that will be hit hardest during this pandemic. So you talked about it a little bit about what you're doing, but tell us about how you're dealing with this and the things you're having to go through to support your restaurants, because you've got quite a few, and you've only just started the takeaways. So what else have you been doing to keep afloat?
The biggest thing we've had to do is the management of cash flow. And, you know, the last thing I wanted to do as well is just turn around to every single supplier and say, I can't pay you. So we've managed to pay all of our suppliers. We've had a grant, we've had two council grants, which, you know, I'm sort of very disappointed in the government from that sense that, like, you know, Number Six qualified for one and Padstow Townhouse qualified for one, you know, 10 grand and 25 grand. But Reggiano's and Mariners, just because they're over that rateable value of £51,000, I've still got the same problems. I've still got the same overheads. I don't know how they think a small business is any different to a bigger business. All it is bigger overheads. It's still got the same problems. It's still got the same cash flow issues. So that was a real kick in the teeth. There was no support for Mariners and Cafe Reggiano. I basically borrowed money on these bounce back loans. These basically COVID retention loans. The honest answer to give you is that if we open in July, then between loans and overdrafts, once we get trading again, we will see how it goes. But that's a significant amount of money that we've borrowed. Yeah. As you can imagine, in December, me and Emma took the before December, but it officially happened in December. We took the decision to buy Reggiano's. Not something that restaurateurs always have the opportunity to do, but we did. Huge yeah. risk. We got a lot of a lot riding on that. All of our businesses, our house, everything. So you can imagine, we just bought Reggiano's in December, and then in March we get shut down. So it's all about managing the cash flow, and it's about making sure that you do the right thing by your suppliers, by your team. Don't get me wrong, furlough was a huge help, but furlough stopped a lot of businesses falling off the edge of the cliff. What it hasn't done is solve the whole issue. All it's done is stop everyone going off the cliff. Once furlough stops, it's then about making sure that you survive and carry on. So yeah, we borrowed a lot of money, and we are just doing everything we can to kind of stem that cash flow and make sure that we come out of this. Takeaway will just go against a huge loss. That's it. It's not going to be the turnover that we normally generate. We know that. We're doing burgers and hot dogs and fried chicken. Mm-hmm. And there's only so much volume of that we can do, but you're constantly planning strategies and putting together thought processes of how you reopen and how you manage to trade when we reopen, and that's something that we've been planning for quite some time. But also as well, you haven't got an end game of that, Shalini. We haven't got all the answers yet. We don't know what that looks like. There's got to be more information coming from the government. So it's all very well thinking, right, you know exactly how it looks when your business opens, but it might change. Things might change. We've still got a long way to go until the July the 4th when they're going to start to phase hospitality back in. So, yeah, all you can do is stay as positive as you can, and that's why we do the community stuff. That's why we do the takeaways, is just to keep staying positive, keep putting good vibes out there and hoping that that we can all come out of this the other side. And my main focus is not to make people redundant, to make sure that none of these businesses close and that we come out of this. But the reality also is we're going to come out of it with a lot of debt. Yeah. Nothing to show for that debt. It's not like we're going to come out and then go, yeah, we've got a lot of debt, but we've got another set of bedrooms, or we've got this. All we've done is got a lot of debt to stop the company going bust. And it's going to take a long time to recover, certainly for my company. I project it's probably going to take us 2 years to get back to where we were.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So just moving off topic slightly, I mean, we've missed the dancing around the maypole traditions this year because of the lockdown.
Yes. As
well. In normal times, are you a Morris dancer?
No. And let me give you a little bit of advice. Don't ever, ever say that out loud. Because if you call Padstonians Morris dancers on May Day, honestly, you will be in trouble. I'm helping you out there, all right?
Okay. This is a point where we edit. All right. Okay. Well, we're moving on again.
No, I've got involved with a couple of May Days, like when I first to move down here. But May Day is a day for the folk of Padstow. And you know what? They deserve that day. They really, really do. You know, you've got to remember, their town has become a real tourist hotspot. And sometimes that is frustrating, you know, because it's like, it's their town and it's taken over by tourists, you know, throughout the whole of the year. And it's a day that I really admire them for. It's about tradition, and I love tradition. And do you know what? When I first moved to Padstow, I always remember going into a pub and a landlord saying to me, he went, one of the things I love so much about Padstow is it's like red tape has managed to kind of like almost not get to Padstow. And it's true. And you know what? There's so many traditions that they have. And, you know, May Day is one of them. And it's a day for the Padstonians. It's a day where they celebrate the month of May. It's about fertility. It's about, you know, just all getting together and bonding and all of that. And now I just kind of, you know, I leave them to it. And it's their day. I think it's a day that's where the town comes together. As a unit, as a proper local unit, without the tourists there, and they just have a great time. So it's a, but don't ever call it where I start. You get into a lot of trouble.
All right. I will not forget that. So I introduced you as the culinary king of the Southwest, but it must be like
I'll happily take that. Thank you.
Well, it must be Game of Thrones with Rick Stein just next door. How do you guys get along?
Really well. I mean, if I'm really honest with you, you know, as everybody knows, Rick spends quite a bit of time in Australia. So, like, don't you? You know, when I see Rick, we have a nice catch up, you know, about business, all of that sort of thing. But I don't actually know Rick as well as what people might think I do. The person that I do know really well is his ex-wife, Jill Stein. So Jill is still massively involved with the businesses. Obviously, I know his sons really well, in particular Jack. And, you know, they run it. They run the operation. And Jill has been, you know, she's been amazing. Like when we won a Michelin star, she was at the seafood to greet us. You know, Tom Kerridge drove down with his wife Beth and surprised me. And me and Emma, and they took us for dinner the night we got the star, and Jill was there to welcome us with a bottle of champagne. And we have an amazing relationship with them, and we have an amazing relationship with their teams as well, their head chefs, their managers, their operations directors. And that's what it's about, you know, because I'll happily sit here and tell you that when the opportunity of Padstow was presented to me by Derek, he gave me the best bit of advice that I probably might not have known or put into practice if I hadn't had those wise words off of someone like Derek. And it was, don't go down to Padstow to compete with Rick. Go down there and compliment Rick. And it's something that I've always done. Yeah, since Great British Menu, certainly, and winning the Michelin star, we've created our own following and people come to Padstow for us and to rock and all of that. But in those early days, Shalina, we were the second night restaurant. We were the third night restaurant. Everybody was coming for Rick Stein, but they like Derek said, you're not going to eat with Rick for your whole holiday. People are going to want another alternative, another choice. And we were that choice.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we've built this brilliant relationship with the Steins, because we fully respect and know that the reason we moved to Padstow was because of what Stein family had done in Padstow. And it's as simple as that.
So naturally, one would assume that number six would be a fish restaurant, but you're actually a great meat lover. So how do you balance the menu?
Yeah, you're right. Meat and vegetables is, you know, I'm really passionate about. So we work with Philip Warrens, and we work a lot with local farmers like Ross Geach and people like that. And it was about building an identity and a personality without just trying to be different for the sake of being different. I'm in Padstow. Rick is the king of fish. You know, everybody associates Rick Stein for fish. And in the beginning, in the early days, we were kind of half and half. We had a few meat dishes and a few fish dishes because that was how I was cooking in London. And then I met Philip Warren and his son Ian. And if you ever get the opportunity to go there and see what they do, it's phenomenal. So in a nutshell, they work with the best farms in the Southwest, Devon and Cornwall mainly. and they are getting the best breeds, the best meat possible. And they set up this incredible facility to dry age it, mature it, look after it. So we're talking from ducks to beef to lamb to chicken, everything, guinea fowl. And I was like, we need to be shouting about this. We all know that Cornwall is next to the sea, and we all know that Cornwall is built on some of the best seafood in the world, but also it's got some of the best farming. It's got some of the best land in the world. And why is it brilliant? Because it's that mild climate. So in Cornwall, generally we have a milder climate throughout the year. So these beautiful animals graze on the grass pretty much all year round. So then they've got wonderful marbling, wonderful fat, the texture of the meat, the quality of the meat is phenomenal. And it's like, well, we need to be shouting about this. And then what we found was people were going to like Rick and some of the other restaurants in the Padstow area and like proper, like literally ODing on fish. And then they were like, I fancy a bit of meat. And that was how it started. And it started, you know, by supporting like Warren's and Philip Warren's, which is now supplying, you know, pretty much all of the, you know, Michelin star restaurants in London, you know, and the best restaurants in, you know, in the UK. And it's just been it's just been part of our tapestry and our journey slowly but surely that we've just kind of got into. And now it's who we are, it's what we do.
And how would you best describe your food at Number Six?
Yeah, do you know what? I get asked that question a lot, and it's actually not me that made it up. It's our fish supplier, Johnny Godden. So he runs Flying Fish. He's one of my good friends, and Johnny has been on the journey with me. Johnny was our fish supplier right from day one, and Johnny loves food. He knows food inside out, and so you know when you ask that question, generally it'll be like, oh well, it's modern British, or it's yeah, we're fine dining, or we're this or we're that. And you're like, well, what does that actually mean? And Johnny, like, as you know, he's eaten all of our menus over the years. And he said, do you know what, Paul, what you do at Number Six is serious cooking, but it's fun, serious fun. And I actually think of all the times I've heard our food described, that's probably my favorite way of putting it, because I am, you know, my personality is quite fun. I'm an upbeat guy. I don't take myself too seriously, but I know what I want, and I'm driven, and I want to be the best I can be. So don't ever mistake that for, oh, it's all a laugh and it's all kind of, you know, fun and games. It's not, you know, like, you know, the style of food at Number Six is very, very driven. It's very serious, and it's built on the, you know, the highest disciplines that we can achieve every day. But it's my personality on the plate, and it's about people coming there and having fun. And I think if I asked you, Shalina, tell me your best ever meal, I guarantee you it wasn't just about the food you were eating. I guarantee you it was about the wine you drank, the restaurant you were in, the ambience, the atmosphere. You may have even got talking to the table next door, or you may have been on a table of four or a even larger table. So it's about the stars aligning. So when you come to Number Six, gastronomically, we are trying to be the best we can be every day, but actually we're trying to make the stars align as well. We're trying to give you the best experience. You know, Number Six is a house, and we're trying to welcome you into our house, which is our home. Yeah. And that's what we try to do.
And where do you find the inspiration to develop new ideas?
Everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. Like, you know, you've got your heritage, which is the people you've worked for, Gary, Gordon, Marcus, restaurants I've eaten in, stages I've done when I was younger and would go and work in restaurants for free. And then you've got situations that you might be in, dreams. Like literally it can come from anywhere. Like the other day I woke up at like 4:30 in the morning, my head was buzzing with ideas. I got up, Emma's used to it by now, and I just went downstairs. It's getting light, it was beautiful. Like, you know, like I said, we live in the countryside, drew back the curtains and I just wrote everything down. And the inspiration just comes from everywhere. And you know, and what I try to get from the dish is that it's all about how it eats, and it's all about the flavor. And quite a lot of chefs don't taste their food. They kind of drive it through technique. They drive it through what they think is in and what's fashionable and that. But actually, it's got to be about flavor. You know, that Netflix series by David Chang, that Ugly Delicious. Like, I wish I came up with that, because that to me is exactly what it's about. Like, it's not about pictures on plate. It's about how does it eat? Is it delicious? Because actually, when you put it together, I just don't think there's any such thing as ugly. I think it's like food, when it's put together and not paying too much attention to it in how it looks, but making sure that how it delivers and eats, that's the magic. That's the beauty of food. And don't get me wrong, I have not known that for a long time. I have been that guy that thought it was all about making it look good on the plate, all about technique, putting too many things on the plate. I've done that. But I've also managed to teach myself and get to the point where I'm like, wow, I look at it. Behind the scenes, there's been so much work. But on the plate, there's like three things. Mm. But they all gel and harmonize. And you love it. And you finish. And for me, the best plate of food should be something you actually finish it and think, oh, I could eat a bit more of that. I want more.
Yeah. I love your passion and your energy behind it.
Yeah, I do. And also as well, I remember, I always sort of tell this story. You know, I always remember when I did Reggiano's, so that's now 11 years ago. I won't say the chef, but there was a chef that asked me, and I know what he was getting at. He was like, how does a chef like you, Paul, why have you gone into pizzas? And I actually remember walking away from that conversation slightly deflated and not really having an answer. I didn't know why. I can answer it now. And do you know why? Because I love food. And that's a simple answer. But I was too young then to answer it. I didn't know why. But do you know what? I buzz off of being here with Jack and me and him constantly going through the science of the pizza base, trying to get the most umami we can out of the Pomodoro sauce on the pizzas. Constantly searching for the best foie de latte mozzarella that we can get our hands on to put on the pizzas. And my favorite pizza, ultimately, I love lots of different pizzas with a few more toppings on, but I love a margarita. And you think about it, like the most amazing base, the best tomato sauce packed full of umami, the best slightly salty, beautiful cheese on top of it, a little bit of parmesan, that lovely fresh basil, and just being cooked really fast, so it's crisp, light. I absolutely love it. Just in the same way as I do cooking a beautiful piece of turbot with an insane, beautiful crab sauce and fresh crab and all of those lovely things that you would kind of associate when you go to number six.
Yeah.
At the same time as when I go to the Mariners and I'm with Joe and Tom, our head chefs over at the Mariners, and we're talking about buttermilk fried chicken and we're talking about the burger and we're like, do you know what? The curry, like let's kind of get into the curry and kind of really look at the spices. And, you know, we've had a couple of people that say it might be a bit hot. So let's look at kind of how much coconut milk's going in there. Like, and that's kind of what that sort of David Chang series is about. It's about food.
Yeah.
And if you love food and now, you know, if I saw that chef again, I'd say, yeah, do you know why I went for a restaurant like Reggiano's? Because I love food, because I've got a repertoire that I can diversify into a pub, into Cafe Reggiano, and into a fine dining restaurant, or, you know, and again, that word fine dining, you know, it's not a word I like to use, but, you know, a restaurant like number six is, you know, that's probably one of my proudest achievements, because I know that not every chef can do that. They're quite one dimensional to their cuisine. Yeah. Whereas I think if you love food, you can, doesn't matter if you've been trained or you've been classically French trained, doesn't mean you can't do a great burger, or you can't do a beautiful piece of fried chicken or a good fish and chips. I mean, some of the most fun I had was when we came up with a fish and chips at the Mariners. And I got to a point where I was like, do you know what? Beer batters are a waste of time. They're rubbish. They don't work. They're just sugary and they caramelize too quickly. And like, And our batter, I defy anyone to try and beat, you know, salt, self-raising flour, really, really good sparkling water. So something like, something that's got loads of bubbles and beautiful cod or haddock, light crisp batter. So it's almost tempura-like, but is not as pale as tempura. It's beautifully golden. And we put a little pinch of turmeric in it.
Well, you know what is really nice about all the variety of restaurants that you've got is that, I mean, you're making your food accessible to everyone that wants it. You know, you've got your Michelin star and then you've got your fish and chips and, you know, you've got so much variety. And it's not just because you love food, you also love to share. So I think the fact that you make it accessible to everyone who can, you know, afford all those different dynamics is amazing. Let's talk about how you've turned your business, number six, into an empire. So after you got that one, you got, so your next acquisition was Caffè Reggiano, which you've spoken about. But how did it come about?
So once Derek and once me and Emma had taken on the business of number six, Derek was like, look, this doesn't mean our relationship's over. We'll continue to work together and basically all the accounts and everything like that was, you know, Derek has like a head office. So we did all the accounting, all of the like the administration side stayed within that office. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 years later, Emma, so to make it all work, when we took number six on, I didn't take a salary out of it for 3 years. I did not take a wage, didn't pay myself a thing. And we lived off of Emma's wage, and Emma was hairdressing in Truro in Cornwall. So she traveled 60 miles every day, round trip, and we lived off of her wage. And then she was cutting the hair of the guy that owned Reggiano's. And he said, you know, would you and Paul be interested in buying Reggiano? So again, fast forward, we rang up Derek and said, listen, you know, this has happened. Obviously we can't, we, you know, back then we couldn't go to the bank and say, look, can we buy Reggiano? So we agreed that it would be a great deal, and we bought it together, and basically we did a deal where, like, again, Derek would look after the administration side of it all, and me and Emma would run it. And that's what we did for 10 years. And then in that 10 years, we, 5 years later in 2015, we acquired Padso Townhouse, and that was our rooms. And we turned that into six luxurious bedrooms to complement what we were doing in Padso. And then
that
2 years later,
wasn't it?
Sorry?
Was it grade listed, Padso House?
Yeah, it was
grade
listed.
Must have been quite difficult to do the renovation on that.
It wasn't. It was... What was good was it was so knackered and it had been abused so badly by the previous owners, mm-hmm. that actually the council, which by now the guard had really changed on Cornwall Council, and the planning department really changed and were really kind of open to us respecting the heritage of the building, but also, do you know what, this building's on its knees. And you guys want to invest in it, and you guys want to make it brilliant again and restore it back to its former glory, because it's been a hotel since the 50s. Mm-hmm. And they were like, as long as you respect the heritage of the building and you don't try and change it by adding anything to it, you know, like, get on with it.
Yeah.
And plus we've got form by now. They'd seen what we'd done at number six and they'd seen what we'd done at Reggiano's. So it took a year. It was an amazing renovation. It was, you know, my wife Emma and a absolutely incredible interior designer called Eve Cullen Corns. Together, they just did something absolutely spectacular. And you know what? As well, Shalina, Padso Townhouse is very important, because do you know what? That for me is when our identity truly was born.
Right.
Because number six was still effectively kind of the same as what it was when we bought it off, or when Derek had bought it off of the previous owners. We even still had artwork on the wall from the previous owners. So what Townhouse was a chance for us to really like almost unleash our inner design, our inner selves, and what we truly wanted. And then Townhouse was the very first one. 2 years later, we then did number six based upon all of the design that we'd done at Townhouse. Mm-hmm. This year we did Cafe Reggiano in January, and that's when we changed the name because it was called Reggiano's in the Square. And then the big curveball in all of this was the pub, the Mariners. That was not part of our plan. The cookery school and chef's table was, and we were literally quite happily getting on with that. We started work in November 2018. Mm-hmm. And then I was filming Great British Menu as a judge. I was in Stratford-upon-Avon, and I get a call from Sharps Brewery saying that they were moving on. Nathan Outlaw and Sharps Brewery were parting ways, and would I be interested? And at first I turned it down. I said, no, I'm not. It's the wrong time. I'm doing a cookery school. But also as well, me and Emma have always worked for ourselves, and I didn't want to get into a partnership with being almost like a name in a building. I wanted to, if I'm going to do it, it's got to be for us.
Right.
So I went back to Sharps after, you know, numerous sort of phone calls with Derek and also Tom Kerridge. You know, as we know, Tom's the master of pubs. And it was funny, both Derek and Tom were like, look, if you don't do this, we'll do it. And that was kind of the conversation. So I went back to the brewery to a guy called Ed, and I said to him, listen, I'm interested in this, but it's got to be on our terms. And they were like, listen, Paul, we've also made some mistakes over the years, and we kind of are really up for negotiating what we want to do with a pub and what we want from a pub. And they were like, we know that we're good at making beer, but we're not necessarily good at running a pub. So I said, okay. So they said, everything is up for negotiation. So after the negotiating a deal, they gave myself and Emma a 25-year lease, which is what we wanted.
Right.
And then we put our money where our mouth was. We invested a huge amount of money into renovating it, changing it. And again, so proud of it. So, so proud of it. And I was nervous about that one because I kind of knew that there was a community there, and I thought, do you know what? I'm sure there's a community here that's dying for a good pub to get, you know, to really kind of get behind it. But you know, that's all speculation. But do you know what? The community have got right behind this pub because it's Rock, and Rock is more seasonal than Padstow. And, you know, Rock really is about those sort of 6 to 10 weeks of the year, you know, when they're kind of the holiday makers are down here, but you know, what about the rest of the year? And you need the locals behind you, and they really have. So just like how the locals support us in Padstow, the locals are supporting us in Rock. So at the end of 2019, all of a sudden we've got five businesses, and you know, a cookery school, a pub, and a casual sort of pizza pasta restaurant and a Michelin star restaurant in number six. But as you quite rightly say, everything comes from number six. The DNA of number six is in everything. We're not cooking turbot at the Mariners, or you know, beautiful beef and sort of, you know, high end cuts of meat at Reggiano's and at the Mariners. But what we are doing is applying the same discipline, the same way that we look at a pizza. The same way we look at fish and chips is exactly the same way as we look at a beautiful dish at number six. And yeah, here we are. The working class lad from Southampton who never in a million years, never in my wildest dreams did I ever know that my life would end up in Cornwall and be sat here.
And running an amazing business empire.
Yeah, with the employees, you know, that, you know, in the summertime when we're at full capacity, employs over 160 people.
Brilliant.
Which is amazing. And I never ever take anything for granted, because one thing that's been drummed into me by the great chefs I work for and the incredible businessman that is Derek, that has taught me so much about business, is that you're only as good, you know, you're only as good as your last service, your last meal you cooked. Yeah. And if I could give, you know, advice to kind of, you know, to anyone going into, you know, to business, one thing I've learned is that it's won and lost in the office. Yes, it's won and lost on the front line, because actually, if your product's not right, then there is no office. But don't ignore the office side, especially in this industry, because if you do, you will fail.
Yeah. So just moving away from the businesses, you're actually your chair of judges for the National Chef of the Year competition for the next 3 years. So did that accolade come as a surprise to you?
It did. Can I just say, you are like so well informed. You are like on it.
I do my research thoroughly.
Yeah, I can tell. It did. And it was something I was so proud, you know, to do. You got to remember, National Chef of the Year has been sort of going since like the, you know, the 70s. And it was something that I like knew like about when I was at college. I remember going and watching Kevin Viner in the finals. I remember that when I started for Gordon, it was something that Gordon would speak about, winning it. And so then you sort of like fast forward and you're asked to be chair of judges for like the next 2 years and bring your own input, your own thoughts and ideas. I mean, stuff like that proper humbles me, because I never will forget the journey that I've been on to kind of get to this point and to talk to the people I talk to and be involved in the things that I'm in. And, you know, being chair of judges for National Chef of the Year, yeah, it's humbling. I pinch myself. It's incredible. And you think, like, these people were interested in what I want to say and like what I've got to say. You know, when did that happen? Amazing.
And you've just won GQ of the Year as well. What does that mean for you?
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. that's GQ, isn't it? It's one that a lot of my mates were like, really? Like GQ? And I'm like, what are you trying to say? Like this. And do you know what? On a serious note, again, never in my wildest dreams did I ever think that I would have an association with GQ. I mean, that is proper cool. But the support from GQ. So just recently, you may have seen that I did three films for GQ and Michelin. So Michelin were the partner to behind the GQ Car of the Year Awards. I love cars. I love bikes. I love GQ. Like Michelin is just the absolute, you know, the whole thing of my industry, you know, to be a Michelin, to reach that goal of being, you know, of having a Michelin star restaurant and being in that circle is everything. So this was just the coolest thing ever to be involved in. And I'm not going to lie to you, like that was off the scale. And then I got a phone call. So we did all the films and I thought that was it. So these films were for when they, you know, when they're shortlisting all the cars and motorbikes. And then I get a phone call from the associate editor saying, Paul, will you host the car awards with me at the Corinthia Hotel in London? And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, I want you to host the car awards with me. So, you know, we basically bring up the category. Then a celebrity would come up. So it was like David Gandy was coming up to announce the awards and all this. But we were the hosts. And like, again, you're just like, I'm just like, this is a lad from Southampton that used to be playing roller hockey on the streets with my mates. And here I am hosting the GQ National Car Awards, like with Michelin. And here we are. Here's Jeremy Clarkson coming up to collect an award, and Dynamo and David Gandy and all these kind of celebrities and that and stuff. So, you know, stuff like that's amazing. But I've also got people in my life, you know, like my dad when he was here. And his words still, ring true. And I am very lucky. I'm surrounded by amazing people and friends. You know, like Derek and his wife, and my wife's family, and my mum, and Tom Kerridge is one of my closest friends. You know, these people, you know, they keep me grounded, you know, and it's about being grounded. Never, ever, ever, ever sort of take that stuff for granted or actually think of it being more than what it actually is. And the most important thing that I've always, learned is that, you know, the most important thing is the businesses. the businesses and the people in them. And, you know, the minute you kind of get lost in all the other stuff's brilliant and it's lovely, and doing the television stuff and all that is good. But, you know, people often ask me about television, you know, like Shaleen. I mean, I don't do those. I'm not, you know, I'm not someone like, you know, like a James Martin, or I'm not on television as much as, say, someone like Tom is. But the bits I do, you know, I never went to drama school or wanted to be an actor or wanted to be on television. It's just that food has become so popular. My industry has become so glamorized. You know, it's so kind of like, you know, like in the limelight now, that you kind of just roll with it. You go with it. And I am in a town with Rick Stein, and Rick Stein is a very famous face. And what the television does do is it promotes my business, and it promotes my business and helps get the message out there to come to Paul, you know, to a Paul Ainsworth restaurant, to come to one of our establishments, to come stay with us, to come to the cookery school. And that's why I do it. Not because I want to be famous, not because, you know, I want to be a celebrity, not at all. It's because, first and foremost, I'm trying to do everything I can to look after my businesses and get my businesses out there so they work. Because if they don't work, I don't just lose my job, I lose everything. I lose my house, I lose everything. So that's a hell of a responsibility. And also my team. There's a lot of people, when you employ like 160 odd people, there's a lot of people relying on you. And one thing I've learned is, well, you've got to times that number by at least 5.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these people, they might be the sole income earner for their business.
Yeah.
So if you're not there and they lose their job, their children, their partner is affected. So yeah, it's a massive responsibility. But, you know, yeah, it's also the stuff like GQ and all of that is also very nice. It is. It's a real perk, definitely. Yeah.
Well, we've talked about many pivotal moments in your career. Which has been the biggest moment, the one that stands out the most to you?
Winning the one that stands out the most to me, and I can answer it for you, is winning the Michelin star.
Okay.
That was like a point of you've been working to that point. It's almost like that, yeah, everything you've been doing, everything you've sacrificed, everything you've done from the age of 16 when you knew that you wanted to be in this industry, came to that. To that moment. And I think the year that we won it, in the way that we got it, was so special. It was the year that the Michelin Guide, they announced twice, in the January and in the October, so that the following year in 2013, they were then moving from January to October. So it was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I get a phone call from a chef friend of mine, Simon Holston. And he said, look, I really, really don't know how to tell you this. And because if it's not true, I'm going to feel like an absolute ass. So, but I think you may have won a Michelin star. Now, the guide was due out beginning of October, and I think it was September 27th. So I went, right. He went, just go and have a look on Twitter. So I went on Twitter and I clicked on the link, and it said number 6 with a Michelin star. So like, Emma starts kind of like, you know, Emma, my wife, is like getting like, you know, she literally like bursts into tears and everything like that. And I'm like, well, we just need to kind of hang on here. So my next phone call is Tom Kerridge, and I ring Tom up. Tom says, look, I'll text you the number for HQ, Michelin HQ. All you can do is give them a ring at 9 o'clock. So I rang them at 9 o'clock, and it was like, I look back on that day, and it was even the guy that answered the phone. He's like part of this story. He makes the story. It Michelin answers the phone. And he says, good morning. And I said, good morning. My name's Paul Ainsworth. I've got a restaurant in Padstow called Number 6. He said, okay, young man, like this. And I was like, I've had a phone call, and I've gone online, and it says that Number 6 has got a Michelin star. And he was like, well, does it, young man? That's interesting, isn't it? And I was like, Yeah. And Emma's like this. She's literally right next to the phone, like that. And I'm like, yeah. He says, well, he says, if it's there in black and white, then I would take it as good as you've won one.
Brilliant.
And oh, my, like now, telling you now, like just literally full of goosebumps. And Emma just burst out crying. And I went, okay. And he went, have a good day, won't you? And I went, yeah. And I can remember it vividly. And like literally, like I had tears rolling down my face. And then at midday, it was announced officially. And that day was, and you got to bear in mind, I was getting messages. I like Rene Redzepi from NOMA, like the, you know, still now, but like one of the most famous, greatest chefs in the world, sending me a message on Twitter saying congratulations.
Awesome.
Phone calls from chefs that didn't have my number ringing me up, like David Everett Mateus and people like that, wishing me congratulations. Like press, magazines, all of that. My feet did not touch the ground all day.
Yeah.
So then in the evening, it got to 6 o'clock, and I, do you know what? I just wanted it all to stop. And what I, the thing I wanted to do was get on the pass and just cook with the boys and send the food, because all of a sudden now those dishes, they were Michelin star dishes. This was a Michelin star restaurant. We weren't part of the hundreds of thousands of restaurants in the UK. We were part of 100-odd restaurants in the UK that had a Michelin star. And all I wanted to do was push that food across the pass and say, yeah, it's different. It's a Michelin star restaurant. So anyway, we're about to start service, and I'm walking up to the back to check on pastry, and literally all I can hear is, oi, oi, like that. And I look round, and it was Tom and Beth. And they were like, we've booked a table at the seafood. Everyone here knows that you're not going to be here tonight. We're taking you to the seafood for dinner. And again, that's why they're like our best friends. And they took us to the seafood for dinner. John, my head chef, who has been with me since day one, is still with me now. He had the night off, so he joined us. We got to the seafood. Jill Stein was waiting there with a bottle of champagne.
Brilliant.
And it's everything. And it's, wow, it's all your training with Gary and Gordon and Marcus. It's everything. It's everything that you want. And it's amazing, and you never take it for granted, because what people don't realize is you've only got it for 1 year.
Yeah.
And that's what people forget. You've only got it for that year. You're in that book, you're announced, you've got it. It's about maintaining it. It's about maintaining it and making sure that the standards and the consistency of what you do is fantastic. So yes, the elation, the joy, the everything is incredible. But then it's like, yeah, great. But like with all things good, you've got to then make sure you maintain it and you know, the partying and all of that. You got that. That's brilliant. You've done that. And we you know, we got so drunk at the seafood. It was absolutely brilliant. But then the harsh reality is, you got to keep it now.
Yeah.
You got to keep it.
And it's the last meal, as you said.
Absolutely. And I never look at that as a burden. It's never a burden. If you make it a burden, there's no point having it. It's no point having it. What you got to do is believe and just be absolutely consistent all the time. Michelin star restaurants make mistakes. Michelin star restaurants don't have the perfect service 365 days a year. But, you know, you've got to go in every day being the best you can be. And that's why I love it. And I think a lot of people are enjoying this series, aren't they, on Netflix at the moment, The Last Dance with Michael Jordan.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard constant good stuff about it.
Chefs can really relate to that, because that is what it's about. And that's what Michelin does for you. Chefs want to be the best they can be. And when you work at the highest level, you want that. But with like having 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, a bib gourmand, If someone said to you, I'm taking you to a Michelin star restaurant tonight, it's like that. I compare it to, like, you know, when people say, like, that's the new iPhone, that's the Rolls Royce of iPhones. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's, for me, what Michelin's like. It's like the Rolls Royce. It's like, I'm taking you to a Michelin star restaurant tonight, you're like, oh, really? Wow. And you don't even necessarily have to be into food, because it's known as this kind of like this stamp of quality. And yeah, that is what chefs embrace. That is why it means so much to them. And that's why, you know, it's great to be able to explain it on a, you know, on a platform like this, because a lot of people think, what's, you know, why do you get so hung up about it? And you can't let it destroy you and ruin you, and you know, and that's all you care about. But it's like the Last Dance. It's about being driven and working towards something all the time.
Yeah.
Because so, it's the expectation.
Yeah. Well, I've got one last question for you, Paul. Tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know. You share a lot on Instagram, so I'm looking for something that I haven't seen before or heard from you before.
Share. Okay. So there's a story, right, that Tom Kerridge always threatens me with, right?
Right.
I suppose I better just beat him to it. So we were on a weekend break in Stockholm, and we'd gone to, for me, still to this day, the best restaurant I've ever been to. But back then it was called France and Lindbergh. And it was in the old part of Stockholm. Now it's moved, it's just called Restaurant Franzen. So we ate there, we ate at some other restaurants. Anyway, we stopped in this hotel where we went to this restaurant called Mateus Dahlgren. And it was amazing, really, really good. Anyway, I went to the toilet, and I kind of noticed that there was a lot going on outside and stuff like that, with like a festival, but wasn't really paying any attention to it. Anyway, I went to the toilet. And without going into too much detail, I went to the toilet when you have to sit down on the toilet. And, you know, I was just going about my business. And the door flung open. And like a very immature child, you know, got bearing in mind, I'm a fully fledged adult in my 30s, should have locked the door, but I didn't. Because I'm, you know, like I'm six. And the door opened. And there's this guy staring at me, and I'm staring it back at him while I'm sat on the toilet. And he really does look at me with that kind of, looks could kill, or looks could tell you what he's thinking, like, what's wrong with you? You're a grown man. Why have you not locked the toilet door? So I kind of, but he had a really, really kind of, you know, when someone's got a face, it's like a face you won't forget. So I go back to our table in the restaurant, and like Tom and Beth and Emma are chatting amongst themselves. And like, you know, when I'm just not part of the conversation, this face is just ingrained into my brain. So Tom's like, you all right, mate? And I told him the story, absolutely cracking up laughing. Then as we look out the window, this festival, it's Stockholm Film Festival. So anyway, I said, oh, guys, I know this face. I think this guy was famous. So anyway, after a few bit of Googling and finding it was Willem Dafoe. So Willem Dafoe, like, is, you know, I think he's like the baddie in Spider-Man and all of those kind of things. And it's like, oh dear. Like, it's really, really, really kind of like embarrassing moment. And it was like, then everything unfolded, and then you go outside and you realize it's the Stockholm Film Festival and all of this. And it's one of them stories that is Tom's always threatening to kind of, I'm going to mention that next time we're on Saturday Kitchen together. Got it out there. It was embarrassing. I'm ashamed of it. And and I'm sure Willem Dafoe is never
brilliant
been
story.
The same since.
Dafoe saw you on the toilet doing a number two.
There it is. It's out there.
There it is. Thank you so much for joining us today. You've been an absolute sport. It's been so
honestly, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stories. And guys, if you want to follow Paul, he's on Instagram at Paul. What is your Instagram handle? Is it
Just at Paul Ainsworth. You'll find it anyway, but the O in my name is a six. No underscore.
Okay.
Just Paul Ainsworth, but the O is a six in the worth of Ainsworth. But if you type Paul Ainsworth, you'll find me.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much, Paul. Speak soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Take care. Bye.